You're listening to Face Off, episode 31, recorded August 22nd, 2009. Welcome to Face Off, your face-to-face web technology podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Jade Robbins.
And I'm Mark Sanborn.
And in this podcast, we talk about various aspects of web technology, such as web development, social media, and web entrepreneurship. As always, you can view our show notes by going to faceoffshow.com, and please follow us by going to twitter.com/faceoffshow.
Well, last week, we had a little bit of a mishap, didn't we?
Yeah, I guess it's time for full disclosure. So last weekend, we recorded two episodes.
The first of which,
we normally do. We do, you know, every week we record two episodes. We record our 30th episode. We're really excited because it's our 30th episode. Well, in the middle of doing post-production for that episode, things went very bad.
And we were like, oh, no problem. We've got a backup. And then we also have a software backup, too. And yeah.
Pretty much everything failed because I was not on the ball.
When was the last time you had your backup?
It was like May 18th or something that. So,
well, it was automated and we had it in place, but it was never checked on.
Yeah.
Again.
Well, like, and regularly. Ever since the summer hit, my server, which has our storage on it, has been overheating because my apartment gets really hot. So I need to buy a new. Anyway, so we just released the 31st episode that we recorded to be the 31st episode is what we just released last week. So
interruption in the show. We were just
Just
put another one out.
But being it got screwed up, we're gonna celebrate! Hooray! This is our 30th episode! Yay!
It's actually 31.
Well, this is our 31st, but we're celebrating.
This was supposed
our 30th.
To have been our 30th.
Yeah,
the content wise.
So hooray! We're gonna do some news and follow ups. They may seem a little stale because they're a week old, but they're still relevant.
They're still definitely relevant. Yeah.
But 30 episodes. Mark, what have you learned in doing 30 episodes of Face Off?
There's a lot of web apps out there that I need to be using.
Yeah. Well, and there's a lot out there that you don't really need to be using.
That's
too.
That's true.
One of the most interesting thing I've seen doing the show as far as web apps go is the decline in new web apps as the economy has slowed down.
That's true. A lot less funding.
When the economy was going, I mean, there was all kinds of stuff going on. It was almost a little bit more difficult because you had to pick which ones to talk about because there were so many. Now it's like there's a couple good web apps coming out every week, and then there's a ton of crap ones that...
There's a lot of web apps, too, that do the same thing.
There's
a lot of URL shorteners, a lot of the Twitter, like, you know, the repeat clone kind of Twitter stuff, So, I mean, there's a lot of web apps that we review all the time that don't make the show. But yeah, and then sometimes we'll put on some app and then find out later there's a little bit better one and we'll do another follow up on it. But
so are you happy that we've done 30 episodes of Face Off? Is it?
Yeah, of course.
You're glad you're enjoying it still.
I find we find new web apps all the time. I'm using new technologies that we find on the show and it's good to talk about it. You get to learn
fun.
A little bit more.
So. It's a blast. I enjoy it a lot. So here's to let's raise our virtual glass of champagne to 30 more and on till, what's the saying? On till something.
50 episode. So
there's like a say. It's like second star to the right and on till morning or something like that.
That's Peter Pan.
Is Hook. It? Okay. Because I was going to say a Star Trek quote.
That's totally Hooked. Yeah,
I'm pretty sure I heard it on Star Trek once.
That's totally Neverland. So a web app that hasn't failed, that's actually doing quite well, that we talked about in episode 3 is Mint.
You always got to ruin my fun bringing... Work. Yeah, Mint. Okay. Mint. We talked about it in, I think, our third episode. Great program. I still use it to this day. I use it for myself. I use it for me and my wife use it. I love Mint. They just got $14 million in new funding.
That says a lot in an economy like this that a web app is getting that much funding.
Yeah, it does.
It's basically saying, hey, you guys have a great idea. You're doing good well. You're profiting off of it or you're close to profiting off it or whatever. Yeah. We see some hope in this. For both ends. I mean, it doesn't cost us as a user anything, but it's a very valuable service for the user, and I think it's going to be valuable for them.
Yeah, I think the big question is, what are they going to do with this funding? Are they going to work on their core Mint app? Are they going to do other financial services apps, other financial content? possibly. That'd be a lot of content for $14 million. But I don't know. They just released some new updates to their Core Mint app, some more advanced budgeting, some more advanced like money tracking, and you can expand your profile, which the cool thing about Mint's profile is the more information they know about you, the better ads they get you. These aren't just stupid ads. They aren't ads saying, you know, if you search for fly fishing gear, to say like buy a talking bass that hangs on your wall, it's like no, I can save you this much money. You know, your current savings account that because it knows your information, it says, hey, it's this percent. I can get you one for this percent, save you this much money a month. Or if your loan percentage is too high or your credit cards, it's good relevant ads. So filling out your profile will help them get better offers to you, which save you money. This is why I love Mint, is because it's a free ad-based service, but it's good ads. It's not just stupid dummy. I love Google AdSense, but sometimes it's just dummy Google AdSense ads. These are ads designed to make you money.
Yeah, and one of the things with web apps too, and it's almost kind of like the eBay syndrome or the YouTube thing. It's like once you become kind of the player in that market, nobody else. I mean, that you're like the go-to spot. Like, you know, nobody else goes to another auction site other than eBay. Like, if they were to become the financial place where you funnel all your money and finances through, like kind of like the YouTube of video, I think they could be very profitable.
Yeah, I agree. Like I said, I love this company. They do a lot of stuff. You can tell they really love their job. The Mint blog is full of really good information. They do some stuff with wall stats to give like really cool money visualizations and stuff. I mean, these people really like what they're doing. They're not just there to try and make a buck. They love money. They love finances. They love the market. And it shines through with their sort of extraneous content that they give besides the service that they provide.
Yeah.
So here's that $14 million. Hopefully it gives a lot, you know, a lot more stuff so that company can continue to grow, because I really like it.
All right, so that was kind of a web app that did well. We had kind of a web app that's getting some kind of sour press.
Yeah.
Lately.
It's not a web app.
Well,
per se. It's Digsby.
It deals with web apps, though.
It does. It does a lot. With them. Actually. Digsby is a multi-protocol instant messaging program. These have been around for a while. I think the first one I started using was Trillion back in the day.
Yep, I remember that one. Still out there.
Then I used Miranda, which I think may be dead. Now some of the basic ones out there are Trillion is coming back, but you have to pay for it. Pigeon is a good one that you can get on Linux and Windows. I know. I'm not sure if you can use it on OS X. Adium, I'm not sure how to pronounce it.
I've heard it both ways. So
in OS X does the same thing. And it lets you connect to Google Talk, AOL Instant Messenger, MSN, a whole bunch of different instant messaging services through one program.
Okay.
So I heard about Digsby a while ago, and so I decided to go check it out because someone said, hey, it's really good. It's for Windows, and I haven't heard of a really good one for Windows in a while. Pigeon is kind of stale, I think. I like it. It's functional. It lacks some pizzazz.
It's bland. It does the job, but it's not, I don't know.
So I heard about this because it had Twitter integration, which is, you know, and other social integrations, which I really like. So I decided to check it out, and I went and I downloaded it, and it just didn't really fit.
What was the first thing that tipped you off?
Well, I remember specifically when someone told me, they're like, hey, I joined Twitter. And I was like, oh, that's cool. It's a buddy of mine. And he's like, yeah, so I'm all set. I even have Digsby and everything. And I was like, what's Digsby? And I remember thinking, I searched the internet for it, and it was getting some press. And I thought, well, something has to be wrong, because the community of people I communicate with aren't talking about Digsby, but it's out there and it's popular. Mm-hmm. So something is not. It, you know, if it's good, I would have heard about it. And I'm not trying to be, you know, I'm the best, but I would have. Okay. And so I was like, well, okay. But I decided to check. And then I went to the website. It seemed kind of, you know, and I installed it. And first thing I go to install, it wants to install toolbars. It wants to install different programs. It wants to change my search bar. And I was like, oh, man.
Now, normally a program that you're kind of describing, something that's going to install search bars and all this weird stuff, people stay away from that like you can't believe, like the plague.
Yeah.
They're not going to even touch it. They're not going to recommend it. They're not going to do anything about it.
I mean, there's a couple out there, and I understand that they're trying to make money, because a lot of programs have to make money this way. Like Demon Tools I use is a popular Windows program, and it does the same thing. But I'm just not comfortable with it. I feel that it just shows that they're trying to make money, and it's closed source, and so I just wasn't really comfortable with it. Turns out,
go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, I was kind of right. Digsby's doing greasy stuff.
One of the greasy things was they're going to use your CPU cycles behind the scene to do who knows what.
Yeah, I mean, what kind of stuff are they doing, Mark? I mean, like, is it looking where I go on the internet, or?
I had the link. Where'd it go? What they said?
They do some things like it uses your computer resources when you're not using it. It's doing like some distributed computing stuff. Yep. It's crawling websites behind
basically
the scenes.
It says it can use it to do whatever it needs to do. It says it can do stock market research, search the web, you know, who knows. Yeah.
So
basically we can do anything you want with your computer.
And of course it's buried in the EULA.
Wow.
You know, so
who reads those what yeah, is a exactly. EULA?
End user license agreement. It's that you every
that?
Time you click I agree, man, you're agreeing
they're
to
like
let them do all this stuff.
Like 14 pages long.
They are. But I don't like it, but I almost have to agree with these people when they do it to say, if you click I agree and don't read it, but this is why we have the news, people like us, because we
That's
spread
true.
The word so people don't have to read the EULA, because if they read the EULA of half the programs they use, they would say, oh my goodness, and I'm not going to use this thing.
So some people are like, well, they got to make some money, you know, and you can turn it off. I'm reading through a forum and they're saying, you know, I don't want to click through six different things and then double, triple check to make sure it's not on. And, you know, they're saying to turn it off, you got to go into this help support Digsby and click that. And then you can uncheck the don't, you know, use my CPU and yeah. stuff. It's kind of hidden. It's not out there. Which means it's kind of greasy. So it makes you wonder, what else are they doing that's greasy?
Yeah.
It puts a bad taste in your mouth.
Yeah, it just puts a bad taste in your mouth. You just want a program that's doing good things like this to be good overall, you know? And who knows what they're doing? They may be trying to cure cancer, but they also may be trying to do stock market research to get more money. Either way.
Mm-hmm. And they I mean, they show on the Lifehacker article, so, I mean, this is a big thing. It's not just us being picky. There's a lot of bad press about this, but they're showing a picture with like tons of pop-ups.
And the thing is, if you're obviously what I'm assuming is they're farming out people's extra CPU cycles,
uh-huh.
they're getting paid for it. Then why are you installing all these toolbars and crap? You know what I mean? It's like,
how much
one
money
or,
do you need?
You know, one or the other. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, if you're going to farm my CPU, I want to know what your clear guide to monetization is, right? Mm-hmm. If you have ads in the program, I open the program and I go, okay, ads.
Okay, whatever.
If I install it and it doesn't ask me to do a toolbar, then I'm wondering, okay, how are you guys making money? And then I would look, you know, probably look at them and be like, okay, well, you're using my computer. Okay. It's just not cool.
So a lot of people had liked it before this kind of happened, and probably still some people do. What are the kind of the features that make it? I mean, is it just because of the Twitter integration?
It's a multi-protocol instant messenger.
But there's open source ones that don't have these problems.
Yeah, but it has a nice interface. It's fairly clean. And the big one, yeah, is Twitter. And it does like Facebook chat, MySpace chat integration.
So it kind of ties into the more social scene.
Yeah, it ties into a lot more things. And then like their other one was, you know, it's not ad-based revenue. So there's no ads on your client. Okay. Yeah, not really impressed.
So not worth it.
Yeah, so clean it up, Digsby. Get your act together. I don't know. I feel bad because I know these companies are struggling to make money in a market that is...
How do you make money on an IM client?
Exactly. Maybe you shouldn't have gone to business for that, but if this was their business plan all along, it's a clever business plan. I think it's a good idea if they were open about it. It seems that they were kind of trying to sneak it in.
Yeah.
You know,
it seems to me it's like, let's get popular and then sneak it in and see what happens.
Yeah, that's Ed. I get the same feeling.
All right, enough about Dig.
The next little news and follow-up we want to talk about is a while back we talked about Sinatra, which is a Ruby framework for doing websites. That is the really cool part about it. The killer feature for me was that you make the whole program based on the routes, the URLs.
So real simple routes, and that's pretty much it.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like pure Ruby with routes.
Yeah. So we asked listeners for some PHP clones. Because we figured there had to be a PHP program out there doing something like this, because Sinatra we thought was so cool. And there is. It's called Fitzgerald.
Yeah, so Fitzgerald is a Sinatra clone. It's got the rates. The guy that made it was, you know, he said, I want a Sinatra clone, but I do a lot of PHP work, and it would be nice if I could have that in PHP. So he kind of mimicked the way it would work in Sinatra. Now PHP is not as dynamic of a language, so it doesn't look as clean, but it
Yeah.
It's about the same amount of lines of code to do the same thing.
The Ruby code looks really clean, looks really cute. Yeah, and this
basically
is not a, I don't know how many people are using it, but it's basically it's supposed to be a direct clone of Sinatra. You know, it's supposed to, sure. You know. We were also told that CodeIgniter does the same thing, which is a really popular framework. Mm-hmm. It's a little more beefy. It has a lot more features in it than like Fitzgerald or Sinatra.
Yeah, but CodeIgniter is cool because you can use whatever features you want and don't use the other ones.
Yeah, and CodeIgniter, I mean, one big problem with frameworks a lot is people complain about their speed, you know? Uh-huh. Okay, you've got all these extra features, you don't have to code as much, but your program is going to run slower because you have all this framework goo running around in the background.
Yep.
CodeIgniter really prides itself on being fast and clean. So I remember checking out CodeIgniter a couple years ago. It looked really small, didn't seem to have much of a community, but I think it's really exploded in the past couple years since then.
Yeah, and I got to play with it for a few hours, and I really liked it, so... I'm pretty much to the point where any web development I do from now on is going to be framework because yeah. It's just the benefits outweigh either the performance loss or
whatever. It's just so nice to throw in your framework and you write half as much code to have a full featured app.
I mean if somebody else comes into it and they don't really know kind of what's going on, they can just go read the CodeIgniter API real quick and they'd be probably more faster up to speed than if you had some handwritten spaghetti code.
Well, there are, you know, one of the pros and cons of a framework is that you have this collective knowledge of a bunch of really good programmers writing this framework. True. So they're going to make sure and try and do things like make sure that people can't hack into your website, do validations and stuff for you. But then the downside is, of course, then if it's a popular framework, people can figure out how to get around that and it's easier for them to do it. But if you have a good community behind it, they'll fix those holes really quickly so you don't have to worry about it.
Yep. Leverage the community.
Yeah, definitely. I'm with you. I like frameworks. I'm 100% ready to use them. So.
All right. So what is our... That actually is our news and follow-ups.
Yeah. Let's dig into the web apps. Let's dig into the
first web app.
The first web app is called Thought Audio. So you and I have really gotten into audiobooks lately. And if you work on a computer all day, an audiobook makes sense. You're staring at a computer screen doing reading. You're either reading code, reading documentation. You're doing a lot of reading with your eyes. So an audiobook really makes sense to, you know, if you really want to keep growing and learning, you can read without straining your eyes further. Thought Audio is just a place to get free audiobooks. There's a lot of older ones that have lost their copyright. There are some indie books, you know, like here's Jack London, Call of the Wild, The Art of War by Sun Tzu.
That's a popular book.
Yeah, there's a lot of cool old books. And if you're not ready to plunge in, let's say you want to try audiobooks, you've never tried them before, and you're not really to really drop some money down on something like Audible for some audiobooks or the iTunes audiobook store, you know, get a couple of these free ones, try it out, see if you like it.
Yeah. So these are all free then, huh?
Yeah. Which is really cool because there's some independent ones on there. So if you want to try and find some books that are off the beaten path, like here's the United States Constitution. That's something I think everybody should read at least once or twice. Cool. Yeah. You know, quotations of Mahatma Gandhi and lots of good stuff. Check it out. You know, try and find some audiobooks and try to. You and I just really like audiobooks a lot. You know, when I'm doing stuff around the house, I'll put on audiobook and get to work.
Chances are, if you're listening to this podcast, you're the right fit for, you know, an audiobook. Yeah. You'll have the right kind of personality for it, and you know, I think you'll...
Yeah, I think definitely. If you listen to podcasts, you're probably the type of person that would really enjoy an audiobook. Yep. So check it out, thoughtaudio.com. The next web app we're going to talk about is an oldie but a goodie. Mark and I have been using this for a while, and if you know about it, then you'll love to be reminded of it because you probably haven't used it in a while. But if you don't know about it, then you can thank us later.
Because this is awesome.
Yeah. It's called the Rasturbator.
Now, I've used this app. I mean, I remember using this first, like, in freshman year of college.
Oh, yeah. Me too.
This was... Okay. So, basically, what it is it can take a picture and it will raster it. There's vector images and rastered images. And basically, a rastered image is just made up of a bunch of dots. Mm. And
so, like, your average image on the web is made up of a bunch of pixels, which are dots. Mm-hmm. So, it's a raster image.
Right. And so, what you do is you upload your image, and it will, and you tell it what size, you know, you want. Let's say, I don't know, you want to make a big, huge poster or something. You could say 6 feet by, you know, 4.5 feet. Mm-hmm. And what it's going to do is make this huge PDF with all these pieces of paper with these big dots on it. And you can print it off and put it on your wall. So, you can make these huge posters. Yeah.
And it does it in a cool way. It doesn't just make square pixels. It does sort of like the circle dots like on a newspaper.
Yeah.
So what happens is, you know, like if I just took a regular Photoshop image and blew it up and printed it off, it would look like junk. It would just be a bunch of pixelated, blurry thing. What this does is puts it into sort of the different sized circles like they do in a newspaper, and it looks really good when you blow it up and make it big.
Yeah, so like if you're 10 feet away from it, it's going to look awesome. If you get real close up there, you know, but it's really cool to have like a big, huge picture on your wall.
Yeah, exactly. And you can do it in color. You can do it in black and white. It draws little lines on the paper for you to cut it so you can tape them together to make sure they fit in one thing. I use this a lot. I had actually had a picture of one of my coworkers. Oh, I had a picture I took of him when he was really drunk once. It was really funny. And so I masturbated it and I put it on the big like pegboard behind my desk. And so there's this huge picture of my coworker behind my desk. And it was really funny. I remember when I had to tear it down and it was a sad day for all of us.
Wow. Since they've started, they've made enough masturbations, I guess you could say, to fill up 491 kilometers.
That's a lot.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, if you go on the website, they have both a web application to do it or a desktop application if you want to download and run it to masturbate your photos. They have a gallery with like a bunch of different images. So if you're not really sure if it's up to you, if it's for you, you can go on, check the gallery, see some of the clever things people have done, like taking a picture of their dorm room when the door was open, and then they'll masturbate it and put it on the door when it shut it. You know, it looks really clever. Check it out. It's, you know, it's a really good way to sort of make your own posters and put stuff on your wall that looks great. It's really unique. It's very sort of, you know, Andy Warhol-ish, you know, which is kind of a big thing right now.
It's kind of a cool way. It's kind of artsy because it's usually black and white, and you know you've got some margins on your paper. So I don't know. It's you'll have to look at the, through the gallery and see some of the examples they've done. But it's pretty cool.
Yeah, I mean there was, it's very cool. Check it out.
Try just go in there, throw an image, and just print one off and try and see what it looks.
Yeah,
like.
Yeah, I mean find something cool. I remember there was some Half-Life fans who are like a you know big masturbated image of Gordon on their wall from Half-Life, and there's some cool stuff.
Even if you do like a 5-page or 6-page one, it's pretty cool.
Well, I remember, so I worked at the student computer labs on campus, and one of the perks of the job was, you know, as a student you would get like $10 of free printing every semester, and so the perk was that we didn't have to use our $10 of free printing to print. We could print what we wanted, and it was just a nice way of our boss to give us a little perk for working in the student labs. That came in really handy when we started using the
Rasterbator. When you found about this, you're like, oh, yeah, man.
Exactly, because it's like, you know, I can't really say much for the poor trees that we cut down to do it, but, you know, we went through some paper.
I like want a poster of Bon Jovi the size of a football field.
Bon Jovi. I'm gonna. So this is what I've decided. If we ever get our own studio, where every perfect. Wall is gonna be masturbated with something cool. Dog the Bounty Hunter, and I guarantee there's gonna be a Bon Jovi now. Maybe Michael Jackson.
Oh man.
It'd be the creepiest studio anyone's ever been in.
Who are these people?
So check it out. The link, it's some dude's website / Rasturbator. At the link, the show notes, just go Rasturbate. Even if you do like a let's say a 4 or 2x2 page Rasturbation, cut it and tape it up, you'll love it.
Yep.
The next web app that we're going to talk about is called, I'm almost embarrassed to talk about this one because it's so, it's useful.
Okay.
But it's so simple. It's called Snail Mailer. And you can go to snailmailer.com. And what it does is it sends snail mail letters for you through the web.
So this is kind of like the PayPal of email.
Kind of.
Or did I say PayPal? Bill Pay of email.
Yeah, it is. It's the Bill Pay of email. So you go to Snail Mailer and it shows you a little envelope and you write in the return address and the destination address on the envelope. Then you go to step two where you write the letter, and it costs $1. And what this does is it takes your letter, prints it out, prints an envelope, stuffs the envelope, and sticks a stamp on it and mails it to wherever you want.
That's an awesome idea.
For $1, you can get 4 pages. So
they got high quality color. I don't know, the color laser printer or whatever they got, but they'll print it in color and everything.
Yeah. So
if you're like, I don't have a printer and I just got to mail this guy real quick or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. Your grandpa's never heard of email, but he's nagging at you to to get a hold of him once in a while. And let's say you're, you know, a young generation Xer, such as, you know.
You don't have stamps. You don't have envelopes.
Well, no, you just don't know how to write a letter. All you know how to do is to write email. Well, write an email, and this will take care of that for you, you know. I mean, you got to fool the mind. That's all it is.
You know, it would be cool if you could, like, set up an account and then, like, email, set up like a gateway email where you just email and it just like converts the email to a
So I know what you guys are thinking. Great, you know, cut down more trees, you know, use more paper. Well, they use high quality recycled paper, and they try to offset their emissions with carbon credits. The big question to me is this like someone who has a setup that does this, or is this some college kid who comes home to his dorm room at night and stuffs envelope for 2 hours for $1
that is
a letter.
Yeah, I don't know.
Check it out. It's a clever idea. I was really impressed with the idea. I thought someone who thought of this, you know, was good. But I really don't know how much I'll use it.
I don't know. If they could get enough people to use it to where this became like, oh, just, you know, use digitally send the mail and got the cost down to where it was, you know, pennies over just actually doing it yourself, this could be really cool.
Yeah.
I don't know.
It's apparently a company. I wish I could have got venture capital for this idea. I wonder how that happened.
Well, it's an incredibly simple.
There probably wasn't much venture capital involved other than like, hey, Dad, do you want to fund my business?
I need 500 stamps.
They use Get Satisfaction if you have suggestions to write. So check it out. It's pretty clever. Snailmailer.com.
All right, what do we got next?
All right, let's get into our topics. Well, first of all, I just want to say, if you guys have some news, a follow-up, or a web app that you want us to take a look at, go to faceoffshow.com/feedback. In any of those methods that we have listed on there, get a hold of us, let us know, and we'll talk about it on the show. So do it now.
Right, quick before we close this one, I was looking through their Get Satisfaction, and I noticed somebody was saying, hey, you know, I'd like to send something internationally, and I noticed that they were going to send for the same price for a limited time, send internationally to anywhere for $1.
Wow.
That's a pretty good deal.
There you go.
And it shows that they're listening to their community and making changes.
Exactly. You can find a pen pal in Africa, and it would cost $1 to send them a letter.
But I mean, like, he's looking at his community and saying, oh, okay, fine. Sure. Okay.
I didn't think there would be much of a big community around snail mail. But like, that's awesome.
But okay. PHP best practices for beginners.
Well, no. Get back. Oh. So if you have news, follow up, or web app, let us know, because we want to talk about it.
Yep.
All right.
Send us an audio clip at 31web2tech.
Yep. 31
or website. Email us or leave us a comment and tell us what web apps you use.
We're trying to be more assertive here at Face Off Show. So do it. Go.
Now.
Are you doing it right now? Okay, well, I'll let you finish up. Okay, continue. Thank you. All right, so let's talk about let's break into our topics. The first topic we have is an article we found called PHP Best Practices. And these 30-plus PHP Best Practices for Beginners.
And, of course, I'm going to be already doing all these things.
You better, because you're...
I'm always doing
You're an
practices.
Expert web coding dude, right?
We'll see. Number one, befriend the PHP manual. I do this.
That's a very good idea. Any language you use, you're going to find an API. You know, you're going to want to look through the doc on it because you're going to have little things to look up. Absolutely.
Yeah, and usually it's a Google for something, and the PHP manual pops up anyways, and I check it out, and it's almost always helpful. So
make sure you're using the right version of PHP. You're looking at the right version in the manual. Same with MySQL. I've done that a couple times.
Looking at the old one.
Yeah.
Being like, what?
I want this query work.
Number two is turn on error reporting. You know, this is always helpful in any language, you know, whether it be Perl or Python or Ruby. You got to know what's going on, and turning on error reporting gives you usually a full report on what's going on. Even if it's an error or a warning that normally would not break the script.
Yeah.
But it would tell you, like,
warning.
Exactly.
Like warnings instead of an error. Usually errors are like, it stops the code and it's like, whoa, something is wrong. But if it's just a warning, it won't pop up. Like, same thing happened with JavaScript in Firefox.
Number three, try an ID. I'm not certain I do this, but.
Yeah, I don't know. It depends on what you call an IDE. I mean, what does an IDE do that you need? For me, it's I just need syntax highlighting and like proper indentation.
Yeah.
That's why I use Vim. It does syntax highlighting perfectly. I put on smart indent and it does what I want. That's it. Do you want like step into and advanced debugging stuff? Do you want autocomplete of functions and things? Then maybe you might want to try one of these IDEs. You know, Vim might not be for you.
Some IDEs do profiling and refactoring, so they'll say which functions are kind of slower than other. You know, they can actually see which functions are slower and.
Yeah, I mean, there are some languages that you have to have an IDE in. Like Java, you have to program Java in an IDE. If you don't, you're an amazing Java programmer.
Or a terrible one.
But PHP can go either way, to be honest with you. So,
Number four is try a PHP framework. I definitely agree with this one.
I think I would have to agree with you. Like we said earlier, a good one to start with is CodeIgniter. Another really popular one that is a lot like Ruby on Rails, we talk about Rails a lot, is CakePHP. There's some frameworks that are really lightweight, like Zend, which is kind of a framework.
CodeIgniter is really lightweight. So Fitzgerald is super lightweight.
There's a lot of PHP frameworks out there. I'd say the sort of big two right now are Cake and CodeIgniter. I can't think of any others.
Would you recommend a beginner to use a framework? Or would you say get the basics down on PHP and Ruby? Or would you say, hey, you know what? Just if you want to start doing web apps, go to a framework and like Rails and just start reading the docs.
That's a tough question. If I wanted someone to hurry up and get a full-featured web application, I would tell them to just dig into the framework. But a beginner probably should learn to walk before they run.
Yeah, I would definitely say, especially PHP frameworks, I would say you kind of need to know PHP first. If you're jumping into Rails, I would say you might not need to learn Ruby first. You can kind of learn it as you go. But
yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, I agree.
With
PHP, though, for beginners, like Zend is a really good framework. Like, it's just
libraries.
A lot of libraries. Yeah, exactly.
And you kind of piece it together yourself. It's not a. Yeah.
Yeah. Because, like, this is a great example. Learning Rails, if you don't know Ruby, is hard because. You're learning both the language convention and the framework. And like if you don't know frameworks, you're learning MVC at the same time. So that's why Zend is really nice because it's like, first of all, it'll take care of some of the hardcore stuff that you might want.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's not being really picky about how things go and it lets you sort of free form it.
Yeah. Zend's just kind of like a library that's framework specific.
Yeah.
That's kind of how I would explain it. Number five, learn the dry approach, which is don't repeat. Yourself.
Yes. This is why this is sort of the mantra of Ruby people. I think this is why like, you know, gems are really handy. They're very useful. It's better than like pair in PHP. But it's that sort of thing. It's just like don't reinvent the wheel. Someone already did it. Just use their code and like in Ruby I know specifically, people that are writing this stuff are really receptive to community input. If they're doing, you know, things like Git, you can submit patches and stuff really easily. With PHP, it's kind of difficult because it's really hit or miss. First of all, there's a lot of really old PHP projects out there that'll do stuff for you, but you're like, oh, I don't know, it hasn't been updated in 3 years. And then there's some that are really, you know, really open communities that are great as well. So,
if you've got two pieces of data in two separate places, chances are one of those is wrong. You know, you don't want to be copying, pasting functions and the same function and having it in two different places of the code, you know, because it's going to make debugging harder. You're going to have to go change. If you want to change it, you got to go change it in two different places now. And it just makes things a mess.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So and plan your app out enough to know where you're going to have to reuse components and then making sure you're writing these components so that they're easily migrated from chunk to chunk.
Number six is indent code or use white space for readability. Absolutely.
Absolutely. That would just be silly not to, really.
I want to make my code hard to read. I'm not going to indent. Could you imagine?
Yeah, I mean, what are you programming in there? Yeah. Perl? That's sort of the Perl mantra is the harder to... Like, Perl people try to... They want to write something that confuses other Perl programmers specifically.
Well, so, they'll have specific shortcuts, but they'll usually indent their code correctly, at least.
But still, indented. But yeah. The PHP is nice because it isn't a white space delineated code like Python, so you can come up with your own convention as long as it's good. Like, I am kind of weird about what I tab in and what I don't. With things like Python and Haml and Sass, you have to indent. That means there's an iteration of code
right
going below it, but still indented.
Yep.
Definitely.
Number seven is tier your code. This is kind of like the MVC stuff. You know, keep your logic away from your, you know, templates.
Yeah.
Keep your database stuff away from...
I mean, I kind of did this until I started learning these MVC frameworks. And at first I was like, God, this MVC stuff is just a big pain in the butt. Yeah. But now, like when I was playing around with Sinatra, I was like, man, I need to make a separate file for my database model stuff because I want to clean this out. And it makes it easier to find where to fix problems or where to change things, definitely.
Yeah, it definitely makes maintenance easier too.
Yeah.
Number eight is use the full, you know, PHP template tag, that which is, you know, like the less than question mark PHP. Yeah. Instead of opposed to like the less than question mark and without the PHP.
I don't know. I mean, I don't really know. The reasoning for this in the article is meh. I've never used the full PHP.
And I've always used it.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, I can tell you I don't, and I've never ran into problems.
Never had a problem.
I think when you start mixing, I mean, I've pretty much always done everything strictly on a LAMP server. So it's made, I'm doing nothing but PHP with MySQL, so I've never had problems. I think if you are on a shared host, this might be more important with trying to support a lot of different languages and stuff, maybe.
I guess that's a concern. Is there other scripting languages that take advantage of this question mark situation? Mm-hmm. And then also, are they saying to get rid of the echo and use like that colon? The equals, kind of like the Ruby style there. And is they saying that's not as good? I don't even know PHP had that.
No, they're saying not to do that. I mean, all that is saying is echo with PHP. Yeah, PHP equals.
It's kind of what Ruby on Rails does.
Yeah, kind of. You mean ERB.
Right.
No, I don't think they're saying that at all. They're saying those are bad examples that they don't like. You know, it's like, okay. Because here is a point. Like with ERB, you're doing sort of similar code nesting inside the file. So with PHP, they're just saying, be safe and do it. It's not a bad habit to get into, but I wouldn't say it's absolutely necessary.
If it's a .php file, there shouldn't be other technologies mucking with it.
Exactly. Either. That's kind of my thinking. Everything I name is .php.
How about if you like make a lot? If you're making like an open source or, you know, like a library or something for someone?
Maybe. I don't know. So there's two styles of coding PHP. This is what I found. The one style is that uses it, the people that use PHP as like a pure scripting language. So they're writing PHP and they're echoing out the HTML as they need it and as they parse it, right?
Yep.
The other style is that you basically have an HTML document with PHP embedded in it. Now, if you're doing that second style, if you're doing the first style, this isn't a big deal because you're only doing the PHP tag maybe like once or twice in the document. But if you're doing the other style, I've kind of grown up doing it, and I'm having a hard time getting away from that. It's probably more important to do that too because it makes more of a difference because you have a lot more PHP tags. That's probably why I haven't, because I have so many tags that I would get tired of typing bracket question mark PHP 50 times throughout my document.
Well, I mean, it makes sense to me to use like the equal sign and then have that echo out stuff as opposed to typing echo all the time.
Well, you could use bracket question mark PHP equals hello world.
Yeah. I guess it's not a big issue either way.
No, yeah, I think... If you're a beginner, get in the habit of doing it. You know, next.
Number nine, use meaningful, consistent naming conventions. You know, if you're going to use camel case, whether you're going to use underscores or whatever, just stick with one, and so you can, you know, kind of expect what the variable's going to be.
I prefer camel case.
I do too.
Which is you start out lowercase, and then each word, the first letter of each word is capitalized. There's no space or underscore between each word. A lot of people use underscores. I don't like them.
It seems like it makes a too long of a variable name or something.
I agree. But.
Number 10, comment, comment, comment. And I would say not only comment, but say why you're commenting, not just what it is that the code does. Say, you know, this code is here because
what does the code do and why does it do it? Yeah, exactly. The because is a good test. Do I say because in this comment? Because, you know, there's a lot of business process that goes into when you're designing an application, a lot of meetings to discuss why it has to do it, what's going on and stuff. And that doesn't get communicated through code comments a lot. Uh-huh. It's usually just sort of the semantics of doing it, like, this code does this, and it's like, okay, well, if you know, why does this code do this? Why did you write this function? Because then sometimes you might go through and be like, okay, well, there's no reason that this is still here because they don't do that business process anymore.
Yeah, and a good example was for this would be like, remember the Debian SSL situation where they had this super complicated piece of code? Well, I don't know if it's super complicated, but it was definitely not totally apparent of what it actually was doing.
Yeah.
They had it probably documented and said, this code does this, but they didn't say like why it was doing that. Mm-hmm. And somebody said, no, I'll just delete this because it's not doing anything. And they basically broke all the security.
Yeah. And if they wrote the why, the whole point was it accessed a part of memory that had just random gobbledygook data in it to help seed a random key.
Yeah, the why.
Which is what they wanted.
It was seeding a key. Whereas if they just said, this does this, you know, somebody could just say, oh, well, we don't need to do that.
Well, that's bad programming because that's what it looked like. You know, just accessing a random part of memory for no reason. They're like, oh.
Normally that would be bad, but in this situation, the why part was critical.
Exactly.
So, number 11, install MAMP or /WAMP.
Yeah.
What do you think about this?
Well, okay.
I come from the point where I'm always doing LAMP like on an actual Linux computer, so I don't have much.
I don't. Yeah. So if you're going to do PHP development, at least you're using Apache and MySQL. I think MySQL and Apache are the way to go. I like those programs.
So stay away from IIS.
PHP. Absolutely. Using like ChiliSoft. You've used like an add-in or something. Yeah. Don't do it. But I would also suggest if you're doing development in Mac OS X, that's okay. That's better than nothing. I'm not a huge fan of OS X. I used it at work, but at least it's a developer's operating system at its core. Linux totally is. Windows absolutely is not.
No.
I mean,
it's made for games.
Yeah,
and Outlook.
Exactly. That's the only time I use Windows is to play video games, and if I have to open up Outlook at work in a virtual machine, and I bury that virtual machine as far deep into the caverns of my computer that I can.
Yeah, but I've never used any of these MAMP because I'm always on a Linux computer.
Yeah,
but I'm not definitely not the masses.
They're nice, like for Windows WAMP. If you can stand developing in Windows, WAMP is the way to go because installing Apache and stuff in MySQL is kind of a pain in Windows. So this does it all for you. It gives you one interface to turn them all on and off and stuff.
Like instantly. Yeah. It's You can even carry it around on your flash disk, I think. They have a portable version.
So. Nice. That's handy. But again, at least they're using Apache, MySQL, PHP. That's okay.
Number 12, give your script limits. I recently listened to an Stack Overflow podcast, and they were saying that in all of your websites, if you start getting, a larger scale website, you're always going to have somebody testing the limits of something, whether it be how many, can I send 25 comments out, per second or like, I don't know. Always have a reasonable script. I mean, are you expecting your users to, submit 20,000 comments within 5 minutes? No, probably not.
But you never know. They might.
20,000?
You never know.
Well, then. Yeah.
But if you have this in place, if that happens, it won't kill everyone else because it'll say, whoa.
Wait a minute.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you never know. There might be some bored script kiddie that finds out that your website is taking, unauthenticated post requests. And so he sets up a couple computers to do
20,000 comments.
And it's like, okay.
Legitimate human use would not generate that many comments per second from one IP or something. So
Well, I agree that I don't know. It depends on the app and your size. I think sometimes there's a lot of overhead involved in doing this that I personally wouldn't do, but I understand why they think you should do it, and I probably should.
I guess it depends on the scope and size of the website. For a good example of this is Gmail. If you fail on the password 3 times, you start getting captchas. It doesn't totally block your access. It doesn't say, oh, my God, you're done.
Locked.
But it says, it looks like you're a bot, so we're going to have to put you to the test.
Yeah. Exactly.
That's kind of a good example.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good idea of limits.
Another thing you can do is time, you know, if the script is taking too long, you could say, hey, something's goofy, you know, stop the script, whatever it's doing, say, you know, hey, something's goofy is going on, try again or something.
Yeah.
Instead Agreed. Of just letting it go off to space.
Number 13 is use objects or object-oriented programming.
Yes.
What do you think of this one? Because you're kind of new to the scene, right?
Yeah, I'm a Perl hacker and a what do they call that kind of program where you start at the top and go to the bottom?
Procedural.
Procedural, yeah. I started a few projects where it was definitely necessary to start doing the object-oriented stuff, mm-hmm. and I'm definitely sold on that. Yeah. You know, it's yeah.
PHP 5 makes object-oriented programming in PHP a little bit easier. It's still kind of clunky. It's just not natural. Like, Ruby is from the ground up, yeah. everything is an object. There are no primitives in Ruby.
Yeah.
Even the most primitive thing is an object that you can do stuff with.
Even a piece of text is an object. Ruby even takes it even further.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, but it's good. Definitely the object-oriented programming in general is absolutely essential to know, 100%.
Yep.
Implementing it in PHP can be a little clunky, but it's a good way to learn. That's how I learned about a lot of object-oriented programming, that and then, you know, Java and CS classes. But I tried to remove as much of that in my memory as I can because I detest Java. I hate it.
Python's a good one, too, to learn.
Python's
good. I learned it on PHP, but Python's a good one for object-oriented.
I guess I have a bad taste in my mouth about object-oriented programming in PHP because I started doing it in PHP, I think 4.3, which was really a hack. They basically put in a sort of hack patch to let people do object-oriented programming in some way, and it was terrible. PHP 5 is a lot easier, so give it a shot. Look it up. I think it's worth using.
Number 14, know the difference between single quotes and double quotes. And you see a lot of this in many different languages, not only PHP, but, you know, Ruby,
But this is like an argument in PHP that's been raging for quite some time because it does, there's a difference between them when you're echoing things and whatnot, but.
Yeah. So, like, for example, a double quote, if you've got a variable within this text, you have to use a double quote, or you use single quotes and then concatenate the variable in between and then have the single quote at the end, you know. Yeah.
But I guess what they're trying to say is, like, if you don't need the double quotes, what they're saying is if you don't need the double quotes, don't use it because then it has to parse faster. Through all the text. It'll be a little bit faster.
Yeah, it makes sense, but is it worth your time messing with that? I try to use, I technically, you know, I don't know. I'm kind of like the, I got to get the most performance. And if it's not too much of a hassle, I'm just going to use single quotes I'm not parsing anything. I'm not just going to use, it seems to me dirty to just use double quotes all the time if I'm not actually have a variable inside.
But, so we've talked about this in the past, though.
I wouldn't,
Is that the bottleneck of your application?
No, like, I wouldn't
and
go
of
back.
Of course it's not.
I
you
would
know?
Not go back through a site that I just did and, like, go replace all the double quotes where, you know, it's not that big of a deal.
You know, somewhere there's a query you can optimize that would make
They're
your site
faster
a lot faster. I mean, this
doing
is like,
something like this.
Millisecond shaving type technicalities.
Right. But if you are new to coding, know the difference and just use them as you're going. But I wouldn't go back and change it.
I think most languages use single quotes. In general, I think for a programmer, that seems more natural and elegant. I think as a programmer, we're also sometimes kind of like, we don't like double quotes because sometimes there's like the magic quotes like that Microsoft programs tend to do a lot where it's like the quotes point into the text and like they're Unicode things that look goofy.
Different types of double quotes.
Yeah, definitely.
Now, usually a single quote is not doing any parsing. It's just text, text, text. And double quotes looks for special things like a new line character, special Windows characters, things like that.
Yeah, definitely.
So that's usually the difference. Number 15, don't put PHP info in your web root.
Yeah.
This is obvious.
Just because PHP info is really useful because it'll tell you a lot of stuff about your install of PHP, like what modules you have compiled in that you can use, like curl and stuff like that. But it also will give people the opportunity to see what, you know, your website is and try and exploit that and just get information. You shouldn't have information like that just lying out there unless you absolutely have to.
Yeah, use it and delete it.
Number 16, never, ever trust your users. This is, even if you think you're designing a website that's only going to be used by 50-year-old ladies who know nothing about computers, that doesn't mean that 16-year-old script kiddie that we just talked about isn't going to find your website.
Yep. Be so, a cynical jerk.
Always sanitize any user input that is coming in any way, shape, or form.
Almost all web-based hacks are because of non-sanitized user input, and this is what this is talking about.
Yeah, you were helping me with a project I did. I was helping. I did a project a long time ago, and the guy called me up and he said, "Oh, it got hacked," you know. And I looked through it and I said, "This is the simplest application I've ever wrote. Mm-hmm. I have no idea how this is happening." And you said, "Well, are you checking your user input?" And I said, "Well, there's no forms anywhere in here. There is no user input."
I saw and a get variable.
The whole point is, you know, post is user input. Get in the query string is user input. Anything that comes cookies. In, you got to clean it, man. Input, yeah, sessions, cookies, clean it. Check it. Because that's how people are going to get in. Number 17 is store passwords with encryption. Oh, please.
This is a no-brainer.
It's like when you get that email in your inbox with your password in clear text and you almost soil your pants and you're like, just why are you doing that?
Now, I can see if you're absolutely totally new at programming and you're thinking, well, if I don't know their password, how do I authenticate them?
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't come to mind. It's not obvious.
Yeah, it doesn't just pop into your head.
On how to do this.
So if there is a beginner programmer listening, what you do is you apply the same hash, which is a sort of text transformation routine, to it. So if you hash the password when they save it and you store the hashed password, and there's special hashes that are not reversible.
Right.
That's the key. If I'm storing the hash of their password and you can't take that hash and turn it into their password, you're safe.
But you have like kind of like a roadmap on how to get to that hash.
Exactly.
So you take the user's input. So when the user logs in, they put their username and then their password. Mm-hmm. You take that password and then you apply this roadmap.
The same hash. Yeah, you apply the same hash that you have to their stored password and then see if they're the same.
And then you compare them.
Yeah, because the whole point of a hash is that no matter what text, if you put the text in, it'll come out with the same hash at the end, but you can't reverse it back.
Now, one of the common mistakes then is, okay, well, the first hash that comes to mind is MD5. I'll just MD5 a password. What's wrong with that?
That's better than nothing.
That's true.
First, I want to say that's better than nothing. The problem with MD5 is it's been around, it's in use, it's so well known that people have done what they call rainbow tables, which is where they take strings and they hash them and they just churn on these giant rainbow tables all day, and then they can compare these patterns from their rainbow tables to what your hash is and actually find it. I heard there's like some MD5 error or something. MD5 is really common. It's not around.
What are some of the things you can do to avoid that?
Well, the best way to take care of that is do what we call salting your hash, which is where you salt it with a common word that the other people doesn't know. It's almost like another factor of multi-factor authentication in your hash. So I would take the password and hash it and then salt it, which would put specific characters or certain, formula
stuff
inside the hash so that their rainbow tables of unsalted passwords will not work.
Another thing too is sometimes people will, use this salt and they'll use the same salt on every single password in the entire database. An even a little bit more secure way of doing it is changing the salt per user and storing that salt plus the other salt.
Yeah, so, you salt it with their information. Yeah. So if my password is salted with my username, well, that's an easily mappable thing for you that is really hard for a hacker to rainbow table. I mean, it's impossible.
Yep. So it's like a double salt.
Yeah. So just don't
store it.
Passwords should never be in clear text. They should never be emailed in clear text. They should never be stored in clear text. I don't ever want to see my password ever again. When I ever see my password in text, I have a miniature heart attack, and it's just not good.
Yep. Don't email it. Don't store it.
Number 18 is use database visualization tools.
Right, I don't know. If you're like, if this is going to be a database, it's going to be hit hard and have lots of in and outs. You probably want to optimize it using ER diagrams, normalization, that kind of stuff. Yeah. I don't know if I would necessarily use some of these tools.
They want to use software. The best database visualization tool you have is a whiteboard and a marker.
Yep.
Number 19 is use output buffering. I'm not really familiar with this, Mark. What is output buffering?
Well, the first time I read about this was from the Yahoo like performance expert kind of guy. It was on one of the Yahoo developer articles, and he basically what happens in PHP is it does its script, right? And yep. then it shows at the end of doing its little routine through the entire page, it will display the entire page at once.
Spits it out.
Well, I mean, it's got to go across the internet.
Yeah.
But it's all at once.
But it basically does like work. Here's your page.
Right. What they found on Yahoo was that people don't really care if the entire page is loaded. They only want to see, I mean, it's like 99% good enough if they see the first quarter of the page.
Mm-hmm.
And then the rest could
take. They just want to start reading.
The rest could take 10 seconds to load. They don't care. Yeah. But if they can, the faster they can see that first quarter, because that gets them going.
Yeah.
They got something to look at. Okay?
Totally. That's what makes you mad. When a page is loading, it's blank, and you're like, it's loading. Loading. Screw this, back button, exactly. I'm out.
Now, if you start seeing half the page, and now you can look around. Now you're looking, and by the time you start scrolling, it's probably already loaded.
It's like a progress bar.
You don't even know.
Yeah. It's like an invisible progress bar. If you see the page start rendering, even while it's still loading, the whole thing, you know that something's happening, you're okay with it.
So what you can do is you can use these special functions, which are, let's see, obfsflush, which what you can do is you can say, stop rendering what you have for now, throw that on the page, and then continue.
Yeah.
And so the user can see something pops before up it's done doing its thing.
Great. Number 20 is protect your script from SQL injection.
Yep.
Yeah. Sanitize all user input. This is the benefit of things like frameworks. If they have like a data object mapper, then you get the benefit of all this work of these people designing this framework who know about this and stuff. I can do basic stuff to protect from an SQL injection, but these guys who are writing like Ruby on Rails and CakePHP and CodeIgniter, they know their stuff, and they're gonna do a lot more protective things in there than I could.
Yep, and they give different examples on how to do this. You know, use the MySQL real escape string. Another method, if you're going to do the same query, like, you know, check users, usernames and passwords constantly, a prepared statement is a good way of doing this, and it also will increase, decrease the time it takes to fetch that data because it's prepared.
Yeah. Number 21 is try ORM. So I misspoke when I said data object mapper below. This is what I was talking about, object relational mapping. What this does is it takes your database and it takes a table and it makes that a model that you can, or it makes it an object that you can use in your code. So instead of like doing MySQL queries that return an array and then looping through the array, what you would do is you would do stuff to this object. You never have to do any MySQL at all. This has a lot of benefits. An ORM is really powerful because you can swap the database behind it, and your code doesn't change because all your code knows is it's talking to this object relational mapper sort of syntax, and the object relational mapper is doing all the back-end work with the actual database for you.
Huh.
There is some slowdown. A lot of people will complain that, you know, like word was that this was what was really slowing Rails down back in the day. But it's really useful, and they've got some really good ones now. And it's just, if you can swap out, you're also gaining the benefit of these people writing these ORMs. If they're really good at writing, you know, MySQL optimizations, then they're going to do all that in the object relational backend that you don't have to do.
You might not even know about.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm checking out Propel, which is a popular PHP ORM, and they're saying one of the benefits is that you don't have to worry about escaping data and SQL injections. So if you want to, I mean, if you don't want to worry about these SQL injections we just talked about in number 20, you know, using our ORM, yeah. It takes care of that kind of stuff.
Basically, every framework either wrote their ORM or is using someone else's ORM, and that's how they're really protecting you from MySQL injections.
If you're really worried about slowdowns, write it in the ORM, get the application done, and then go back and maybe optimize it.
Yeah,
if you really have to. You might not even need to.
Yeah. Or if you really want, put some time and effort into developing that ORM to make it better.
Number 22 is cache database-driven websites. You know, oftentimes the database is the slowest part of the website, and if you can cache those, which means you save a static copy of it, you don't have to do those database calls, and you can make your site way snappier.
Yeah, exactly. We use the Supercache system or WP Supercache plugin for WordPress, and the benefit of that is I'm not afraid to get dug.
Yeah, they're saying something about like it can reduce your load time, like just. Like, if you can normally do like 2,000 pages per second, you can do up to like 20,000. It's like totally increases
the
amount of traffic you can get.
So if you use something like that, then, you know, you really don't have to be afraid of, because with social news today, that can happen. You could be getting 100 people a day, 100 people a day. And then the next day someone digs or Reddits or stumble upon your stuff and, you know, you're getting traffic through the roof. You saw this with Nick's Tutor.
Yeah, static pages are nothing to fetch. Like you could fetch, you could put out 100,000 of them in an hour, no problem.
Yeah, exactly. So if you want to use caching, number 23 is use a caching system.
Yep, and there's great ones already out there. You don't need to reinvent the wheel. There's Memcache.
This is great for people like me because I don't know jack about caching. Yeah, just I don't know have somebody else damn thing. So this is really helpful because I would be all thumbs trying to cache my own website.
Number 24, validate cookie data. Now, this is basically, this is like what we talked about with you and your web app that you never thought the get variable was a, like a user input. The cookies, your cookies were are never meant to be really messed with by the end user, but they can mess with it because it's on their computer. So technically, it's a way of a user that can, it's something you're not going to think about. You're not sitting there thinking, oh, the user is going to change this, but they can. So it's basically validated.
Again, never, ever, trust your user. It doesn't matter who you think your user base is. Anyone can get to your website.
Number 25, use static file caching systems.
Yeah, this is, so the other one, it's all the database work is supposedly cached, you know, so it doesn't have to go through the database and, you know, it just creates the page and the page and caches it. This is like using a templating system to cache everything else in the page. Another kind of good way to do something like this is if you use like Google jQuery links in your page, because then if anybody goes to someone else's website that has that external JavaScript call, it's already cached on their website. Smarty does this for you. You know, a lot of templating systems will take care of it for you.
Number 26, profile your code. Some IDEs, like we were talking about a little earlier, can detect slowdowns and tell you which functions are taking longer, you know, which routines, you know, maybe give you some advice on how to fix them up. And
yeah, but again, be careful with these because this is like we were talking about with the Debian SSL bug.
Yeah,
is that it was a code sniffing program that said something was wrong with this and had them remove it. So, you know, pros and cons to everything. This is good because it will find bottlenecks for you and find potential things that are, you know, in computer science, you talk about time complexity, which is like, you know, n log n or something. And if you can improve that, you should.
Number 27, code to a standard. Yeah. I always try to code to standard.
Yeah.
I think it's if you can just go with the flow, which is the standard, you usually will have less problems. And
yeah. Yeah. And by all means, develop your own standard, but look at other ones. When we developed our sort of Ruby programming style guide, we looked at Rails. We looked at even like the Linux programming teams, like their code style guides, to see some of the ideas that they have and things that we liked and integrated it into our own standard and our own style guide.
Yeah. There's definitely different standards, not necessarily like an ISO standard, like a W3C, but like just general, like four spaces versus two spaces versus. There's two different types of way, like displaying a function where you have the curly brace on the same part of the function or down a line, and the other one drives me nuts.
Which one do you use?
I use the curly brace plus the function definition, all on the same line.
Yeah, I go function name curly brace, and then I do that, and then the ending curly brace has to be on its own line.
Right, but there's people that put the curly braces on their own lines.
I know,
and it's just like, oh my god,
why do you need an extra line? You're not coding to my standards, sir.
But it's like the split thing. Like a lot of people use it this way, and a lot of people that use it this other way. Nobody's necessarily.
Well,
I
say the Jade Robin standard is the best standard.
Wow. I agree with you, only because I do it too. Number 28, keep functions outside of loops. If you're going to loop through many, many iterations of something, a procedural is technically faster because it doesn't have to load that object-oriented information every single time. But that's the nature of object-oriented programming. I mean,
exactly. So the editor has a note. He's like, think of it this way. Try to remove as many operations from the loop as possible. That makes sense. But then again, especially like you said, if you're doing object-oriented programming, you have to be using functions. I think the guy's basically trying to say is just trim your loops. Don't do extra functionality that you don't have to inside your loop because that just adds
loop is,
to the memory.
The loop is processing code. It's in a loop. Yeah. I mean, that's where you're going to gain the most time.
So just try and trim the fat on your loops if you can. Yeah. But again, like if you're doing object-oriented programming, you're going to have to. So you're going to have to, you know, just deal with it.
29 is kind of it's kind of the same thing. Don't copy extra variables. Sometimes it's necessary to trim the variable, especially if you're going to use that variable name like 30 more times throughout the document. Sometimes you're going to you know, like they've got like the strip tags.
Yeah. So I did this a lot when I was, I did this a lot when I started programming. I would put something in a variable that was very descriptive, like description, you know, and then as I would do any sort of transformation to it, I would stick it into a new variable because I thought, well, what if I ever need that original variable again? Yeah. But if I ever went back and looked at the code, no, I'm applying this transformation. It really should overwrite the old variable. And the whole point is they just don't, you know, you don't need all that extra stuff storing in memory. Sometimes I would even go so far as, like you said, just to change the variable name, but not even change the content of the variable at all. Now, the editor's note is saying that this isn't that bad because apparently PHP, when the content is the same, it does a pointer, which doesn't use more memory. But in the example that I gave earlier where I would be applying text transformations and always sticking it into a new variable, like, you know, I would have description and that would have description cleaned equals, you know, strip all the slashes out. Then description HTML would be, okay, apply HTML special characters. You don't do that. If you have to look at it, you're probably not going to need that old content or those old variables. So just clean them out and override them.
But like in this example, I don't necessarily agree with, like, they have description equals strip tags, parentheses, and then like this post is, you know, variable. And then they echo the description. Well, like, let's say you're going to use the description variable, you know, you're going to echo it out 10 different times across the page. You're not going to want to have to type out the strip tags 10 different times. Yeah. And then you're going to wonder, what is a strip tags thing doing here?
Well, yeah. But in this example, he's saying if you're just going to spit it out once, why store it in a variable if you don't have to?
Right. If you're just doing it once, then...
Which makes sense.
So, yeah. Either way. 30, upgrade to the latest version of PHP. Yeah. Of course, for security reasons, for object-oriented, you know,
this will get you. Man, I tell you,
there's a lot of people.
There's been some nasty things coming out for older versions of PHP, and it was a really big deal where I worked because we had some old server that, it didn't have MySQL 4. It had, like, MySQL 3 and PHP, like, 4.2 or something. It was so old. And they were afraid. It was just the worst sort of situation ever because they didn't want to upgrade it because it would break people's stuff because they would have to get rid of the old versions for security's sake. And I'm like, so what? If their application breaks, that's a small hassle of compared to someone breaking into the server and ruining everyone else's stuff, isn't it?
And getting potentially data if they're storing sensitive data on the machines.
Yeah, just upgrade. It's always good policy.
31, reduce the number of database queries. Yeah, of course. If you don't need to, you know, do a select all, don't do it. Get only the data that you need. Select only the fields
you need and look at, make sure, you know, do you really need to get all, you know, those users? I was a capital offender of select star from.
Yeah, maybe you could use the previous query instead of doing another query, you know. Just optimize.
Yeah, exactly.
And 32, don't be afraid to ask for help. There's great places to get PHP help. If you're new at it, you can post questions to Stack Overflow. You can check out IRC forums. You can post questions on the PHP manual.
PHP is kind of a fickle beast, though. The community there, there's a lot of really helpful people, and then there's a lot of really angry, spiteful people that are like, I hate kids coding. So I don't know. Sites like Stack Overflow, which are specifically designed to help people, are a great resource.
Yeah, there's this angry guy and he's just not helpful. Just
be careful posting in forums and even in like IRC chats for PHP because there's going to be a lot of cynical, angry people and they might frustrate you.
If you're going to post here, though, don't just say, you know, how do I write a password authentication system? You need more. Be more specific, kind of.
Don't try and get people to do your work for you.
Be very specific. Provide kind of example scripts or code that you're working on to help, anything to help. Don't ask. Try to be as specific as possible.
Yeah, and if you're a student, you better disclose right up front that you're asking for help with your homework because if there is even the slightest feeling that people are doing your homework for you, that you will never get help ever again. All right, well, that about wraps it up for this episode of Face Off. I want to remind you guys that you can subscribe to the show by going to faceoffshow.com/subscribe if you haven't already. You can also leave feedback for the show by going faceoffshow.com/feedback. Please do that. We like any feedback we can get, good or bad. And if you can, leave a review for the show in iTunes. It's a big listener generator, and we would appreciate it. And we'll see you guys next week. Thanks a lot.